to talk to science geeks, but to each one of you, regardless of your background or training in science. Because we know from experience that the study of God's creation is one of the most effective tools to bring people to faith in Jesus Christ. And we want to equip every one of you to bring more people into God's kingdom as Creator, Lord, and Savior. Now, I'm going to begin with a little story. A few years ago, I was invited to address the International Skeptic Society. It was 700 atheists from around the world, most of them well-trained in science. And they were at Caltech, and I got to hear 6 lectures from top scientists on why there is no God. And at the end, they had me debate the particle physicist, Victor Stenger, on the subject, does science provide evidence for God? And you can actually see that entire debate uncut. We have it at our book table, that DVD. But what was most interesting to me is what happened after the debate was over. I mean, I was around for over 3 hours talking to the atheists that were assembled there. And what they told me was it was the first time they'd ever heard a credible scientific case for the Christian faith. And they said, until we heard you, we atheists thought we owned science. They thought we owned science because whenever science comes up, Christians either spout nonsense, they panic, or they change the subject. Now, I find that sad, that here are these atheists who have been exposed to Christian messages for decades, yet this is the first time they'd ever heard a credible scientific defense of the Christian faith. And I could go on and tell you stories about how they responded afterwards. I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is just share with you briefly what happens when you get an opportunity to present a sound, logical, scientific case for Jesus Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior. Now, I'm not going to give you the best example. That would be events that I had in Soviet Russia and in Communist China. But I will share with you the best result we've seen here in the United States. And it was where I was invited to give a talk to software engineers in the Silicon Valley. And 80% of the non-Christians that attended that talk wound up committing their lives to Jesus Christ. 80%. So I talked to them afterwards and said, you know, can you explain to me why we had such a large number of you committing your life to Jesus Christ? And they said, well, yes. What you presented was something that was very rational, very logical, and consistent, and says, you know, we're software engineers. We're paid to be logical, rational, and consistent. It says, moreover, notice that most of us are quite young, and that they work us really hard here in the Silicon Valley. We don't have time to get into some of the moral problems that our peers get into. And so, 80%. Now, we don't see that everywhere in the country, but we frequently do see very large percentages of people giving their life to Christ. And it's consistent with what you see in Psalm 2. Psalm 2, David speaks and says, when we come to the Son of God, we come to Him first with our minds to be instructed. Then we submit to the Son, and then we kiss the Son. We enter into an emotional relationship with the Creator. Now, one of the easiest ways you can get started in using the book of nature to bring people to the book of Scripture and to the cross of Jesus Christ is simply to give them a credible scientific tool, whether it be a book or a DVD. And to help you get started, we're giving away our latest DVD that you'll get to hear speak. It's our virologist, A.J. Roberts. But we're giving away this DVD on why you really should be thanking God for God creating viruses. Viruses are really good things to have. And she'll be explaining that. The DVD does that for you. And if you go to our, in fact, it's in your packet. In your packet, you'll see this little card. And if you fill that out and go to our booth, you'll get this free DVD. And we encourage you, think of some non-Christian you can give that DVD to. And often the best time is when they got a cold or the flu. Give them this DVD about why they need to thank God for getting a cold or getting the flu and realizing what a great God we have. But what I want to talk to you this morning is how do we respond to committed non-theists? Non-theists who are not going to respond to the scientific evidences for the Christian faith. And so the title is, How Do We Respond to the Non-Empirical Non-Theistic Models? And I would define a committed non-theist this way, that faced with strong empirical evidences for the Christian faith, they jump and respond to non-empirical arguments for their naturalistic, materialistic model. And you say, hey, you're a scientist, what does empirical even mean? Empirical means evidence. Okay, is there supporting observations, experiments, measurements that support what you believe? And so for a long time, atheists were appealing to these empirical evidences, but now it's reached a point where the empirical evidences are all on the side of the Christian faith. And so they're now responding with non-empirical evidences. And it's typically, when they do this, it's a cover for the real reasons why they're rejecting the Christian faith. You know, there's typically a personal issue. Now, I would advise you this way. Don't attack their personal issue right off the bat. Unless you've got a really good relationship with them that's been built up over months, I'd advise you not doing that. You'll offend them and they'll run away. And keep in mind that people use these intellectual arguments as a way to shield you from the emotional and personal reasons. Now, if you can give good answers to their intellectual objections, eventually you earn the right to address the real reasons why they're rejecting Jesus Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior. But you have to earn that right. And again, it's consistent with what you see in Psalm 2. You need to have, their minds need to be first instructed. And we need to do this with gentleness and respect. 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give good reasons for the hope you have in Jesus Christ with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. Well, as an astronomer and a physicist, I can share with you that everything we can measure about the universe shouts that it has a beginning. And if it's got a beginning, that implies a cosmic beginner. And I'm not going to take time. I've done this in a number of my books. But things like the rate at which the universe expands, the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event, what we call a cosmic background radiation, the rate at which the universe cools with respect to time, the fact that it gets colder and colder as it gets older and older. We can look at the ages of stars, radioisotope abundances. We literally have an overwhelming evidential case that there must be a God that was responsible for bringing the universe into existence. And if you want to see the latest, I'm bringing that out on a fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos that'll be released in February or March of 2018. Now, it's not just that we've got overwhelming observational evidences that there must be a beginner that brought the universe into existence. We also have a sound theory in the forms of what are called the space-time theorems. And today there are over 30 of these space-time theorems that have been published. But this one probably has the greatest notoriety, namely that any universe that expands, that only a universe that expands will permit the existence of physical life. Any universe that expands on average has a space-time beginning, implying a causal agent outside of space and time who creates space-time, matter, and energy. So the very fact that you're seated here is proof that there must be a God beyond space and time. Because you wouldn't be here unless the universe was expanding on average over its history. And the significance of this is the non-biblical gods of the religions of the world create within space and time that eternally exists. But the God of the Bible creates independent of space and time. Space and time, according to the Bible, doesn't exist until the universe is created by God. So these space-time theorems are powerful evidence. And incidentally, if you'd like to see these theorems for yourself, I brought a copy with me. And those of you who are fans of tensor calculus, you'll just eat this thing right up. So I'll have it up here for those of you in that category. But I want to give you a quote from one of the three authors of this space-time theorem, Alexander Vilenkin. He's not a believer, but this is what he wrote in a book that he published shortly after this theorem came out. He says, quote, with the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Now, what he was meaning is there's no empirically based escapes. Nothing based on evidence will allow you to escape. Shortly, I'll show you some of the ways they're trying to escape that are non-evidential. But here's the problem that Alexander Vilenkin was referring to. The proof of a space-time beginning implies a causal agent beyond space and time who creates our universe of space, time, matter, and energy. Now put yourselves in the shoes of a committed non-theist, of an atheist. You're not going to like this implication. And it's not surprising that they're jumping to non-empirical arguments. I mean, they're committed to the idea that there is no God ruling over their life. And again, there's personal reasons for why they want to might do that. And there's no evidential way of escaping this conclusion. We shouldn't at all be surprised that they're jumping to non-evidential arguments for their atheistic position. But I want to remind you that this is a huge victory for the Christian faith. The fact that no longer are they able to sustain their position with evidence is they have to go to non-evidential arguments. And I actually see this in the books that are coming out by leading atheist astronomers and physicists. In the last 3 years, these books have changed, where they're now conceding that they can't take deism off the table. Even Lawrence Krauss, in his latest book, The Universe from Nothing, makes that statement on page 173. And so the debate has shifted away from whether or not there's a God to whether or not the God that created the universe is a personal being that actually cares what we human beings do. The whole debate has shifted. Now, that's for those physicists and astronomers who are committed to trying to find an evidential way out. They're basically saying, deism, we have to accept that. But those who are committed to a non-theistic perspective are jumping to these four different categories of non-evidential escapes. They're appealing to the quantum gravity era, an era where we have no capacity to make measurements. They're appealing to Bohmian trajectories. I'll define that in a minute, virtual creation, and one you've probably all heard of, the multiverse. Now, I put them in this order because these non-evidential arguments are basically designed to intimidate Christians, to intimidate the theists. And so I put them in order of intimidation. I'm going to cover the most intimidating one first, the most technical one first, and then we're going to go down to the less and less technical. So I don't want you to be terrified as we go through quantum gravity. That's the most technical, and but keep in mind it's a strategy. The strategy is to blow one by you by giving you something so technical you can't follow the argument. But what I want to share with you, you don't have to be a quantum physicist to respond to these non-empirical arguments. And if you do run into a quantum physicist, again, the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos actually deals in detail with all four of these arguments. Quantum gravity, that refers to the conditions of the universe when it was less than 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the cosmic creation event. Now, Big Bang cosmology tells us as you go back in time, the universe gets smaller and smaller and hotter and hotter. And we can make measurements on the conditions of the universe as far back as when the universe was 1/100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. That's how close we can get to the cosmic beginning. Astronomy is such a powerful argument for God because astronomy is unique amongst the sciences. We have no access to the present, but we got direct access to the past because of the velocity of light. The farther away you look, the farther back in time, you're directly witnessing what God has done. And we can literally get you back to 10 to the minus 35 seconds. But we can't get you back to the quantum gravity era. That's an era where the universe is so extremely hot that we have no tools for measuring the conditions of the universe at that time. And that's what has allowed atheists to say, well, since we have no way of measuring what's going on in there, we're free to speculate. And so they speculate conditions that allow them to escape the beginning of the universe and a cosmic beginner. And probably the most famous example of that is from Caltech's physicist, Sean Carroll, one of the leading atheists of our day. And he has developed what he calls the quantum eternity theorem. You know, he debated Bill Craig on this whole point. basically saying, we don't have to accept that the universe has a beginning or a beginner. I've got my quantum eternity theorem. And it's so technical and so complex that unless you're a quantum physicist, you really can't follow the details. It's one way to blow one by in a particular debate. However, what he's actually saying in that quantum eternity theorem is that there's an arbitrarily long cosmic contraction that precedes our current expansion phase. And of course, we can only make measurements during the expansion. We have no idea if there was a previous contraction phase or not, or if there was an actual beginning. Now, his hypothesis, ironically, is consistent with Hebrews 11:3. What does Hebrews 11:3 say? The universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. The Bible does not rule out God doing things before he created the universe. In fact, it's quite clear that God was actually initiating his works of redemption before he created anything. Something I spoke on here last year, how everything God creates is designed to bring about the redemption of billions of human beings. Now, other physicists have commented on this quantum eternity theorem. I'm going to give you a couple of quotes from Roger Penrose. Roger is not a believer, but I think he is a theist. In fact, you can get a debate book that he did with Stephen Hawking, where Hawking defended deism and he defended theism. But this is what he said in that debate book in response to the question, do you think quantum gravity removes the cosmic singularity? And he said if it were like that, the Big Bang would have resulted from a previously collapsing phase. We must ask how that previous phase could have had such a low entropy. Now, I'm not going to give you a lecture on thermodynamics, just simply to make the point. Any low entropy state is a signature of personal design. Entropy means that things get more and more chaotic and disordered with respect to time. What Penrose is pointing out, the evidence tells us that the beginning of the expansion phase was when the universe had an extremely well-ordered state. And so how do you explain that? Without there being a God. And this collapse phase would not do that. Then he also makes a geometric argument that the singularities of collapsing and expanding universes would have to somehow be joined together. In other words, you've got this contracting phase of the universe and it goes down to a singularity, which just means an infinitesimal volume or something that's close to that, and then it goes into an expansion phase. But for that to work, you've got to join that little infinitesimal volume precisely in location with the infinitesimal volume of the expansion phase. And everything in theoretical physics tells us, although that's mathematically possible, it's physically impossible. That's why you can't have wormholes. It's not possible to join together the singularities of two black holes, and that applies to the universe as a whole. But here's where I think there's a fundamental flaw in this quantum eternity theorem. It requires quantum space-time fluctuations that are very large. They're basically speculating, saying, because this is a period when the universe is extremely hot and extremely compact, we can no longer think that gravity determines all the dynamics of the universe. Because when the universe is that small, quantum mechanics now becomes just as important as gravity. And since we have no idea how quantum mechanics and gravity can coexist at that extremely dense condition, we can speculate. And so that's basically the foundation of the quantum eternity theorem. It's founded on the idea that the quantum space-time fluctuations in this extremely early era of the universe are very large. And basically, what Sean Carroll is saying, since we have no way of measuring that, I'm free to speculate and I can escape the beginning of the universe. Well, it turns, if we want to know what this quantum space-time foam is all about, this is kind of, just think of like the froth on a beach when the waves are coming in. So it's basically space-time bubbling up and down at a rate. And yes, if the quantum space-time fluctuations are large, it dramatically changes the physics of the universe. But something that was published a little more than a year ago, and you'll see this in my new book coming out early next year, as astronomers have found a way to measure the size of the quantum space-time fluctuations. So here are these atheists thinking that they were immune from any empirical challenge. It turns out they're not. Because if the quantum space-time fluctuations are large, that's going to change the images of distant quasars and blazars. Now, these are super gigantic black holes, and when we observe them through our telescope, they're very bright, but they're point sources. They have a very tiny diameter, and they're so distant, they basically are a point source. But if these quantum fluctuations are large, and these quasars and blazars are far away, then as that light travels from the quasar to our telescope over time and over great distance, those quantum space-time fluctuations get magnified. They get bigger and bigger. And what does that do? It blurs the image of that distant quasar or blazar. And the shorter the wavelength, the greater the blurring. Now, astronomers have just begun to make measurements on these distant quasars and blazars. I mean, ideally, we'd like to look at a distant quasar X-ray wavelengths. That hasn't been done yet, but there's work being, it's actually underway. But they've done it at ultraviolet wavelengths. And basically what they've already published eliminates all the random walk quantum gravity models and eliminates the holographic quantum gravity models. And these are the models that atheists appeal to sustain these quantum eternity theorems. So there actually is a new empirical way that we can rule out the quantum eternity theorem. And there's a new one that's going to be coming out this December. This December, radio astronomers, for the first time, are going to be able to image the event horizon of the black hole at the center of our galaxy. Now, another way you can test these quantum gravity theorems is by looking at the orbits of stars just outside the event horizon. And again, years ago, atheists said, well, there's no way we're ever going to be able to make those measurements. We've now found a way to make those measurements. And come December, they're promising they'll be able to give their first image of an event horizon of a black hole, and within 2 or 3 years, there'll be several of these. But the quantum eternity theorem not only is not safe from empirical measurements, there are now these two ways that basically could potentially rule it out. One already has. It's not even safe from theoretical calculations. A Christian physicist by the name of Aaron Wall published in 2013 what he called the quantum singularity theorem, and basically proved in that paper that if the quantum space-time fluctuations in the quantum gravity era are not very large, then you got a singularity beginning, which implies there must be a creator responsible for that beginner. And if you read through the whole paper, he says there's a high likelihood it holds no matter how big the quantum space-time fluctuations are. But it certainly holds if they're not large. And the observations of quasars and blazars already establish that they're small enough to sustain the quantum singularity theorem. So, if anybody brings up quantum gravity, it's been taken care of. Highly technical, but it's been taken care of. And you'll actually see some free articles that I've written on our website. Just go to my blog on the reasons.org website, and you'll see some articles, short articles I wrote that basically summarize what I've given to you right now. Okay, number two are Bohmian trajectories. And you say, what are Bohmian trajectories? Well, David Bohm was a New Age physicist of the 1960s. He was basically the one that provided the scientific support for the New Age movement at that time. And as a physicist, he came up with his new way of looking at the geometry of the universe, referring to it as Bohmian trajectories. And basically, he's arguing that we can come up with a different cosmology if we replace the general relativity geodesics with Bohmian trajectories. You say, hey, you're getting a bit technical here. What are these geodesics? Geodesics is simply a technical word for a space-time fabric construct. And this is what it looks like in general relativity, where you basically have the space-time surface, and in general relativity, if you've got a massive body, it will distort the shape of that space-time surface. Now, what David Bohm did is he came up with a different kind of fabric, but it was a fabric where the lines of space and time never cross one another and never join at a point. And then there were two physicists, and this got tremendous web response about a year and a half ago, whereas an Egyptian physicist and a Canadian physicist said, we've now proven that there's no beginning to the universe simply by replacing the Bohmian trajectories or replacing their general relativity space-time with the Bohmian trajectories. But it was a totally circular argument. The Bohmian trajectories, by definition, do not permit lines of space and time to ever cross one another or come together as a point. Now, a singularity is where the space-time lines come together as a point. So they began with an assumption that it's a Bohmian trajectories are all that are allowed. Well, that immediately eliminates the possibility of beginning. A total circular argument. They assume no beginnings and they prove no beginnings. Now, what amazed me is that this paper got published in a peer-reviewed journal. It should have never gotten published. I mean, in fact, as a layperson, you can read the abstract of the paper. And again, I got an article on our website that will give you the link to that paper. And just in the abstract, you can see the circular reasoning. They assume a geometry that permits no beginnings, and then they use that to prove that there's no beginning. Well, big deal. Okay. And virtual creation. This is a favorite of American atheist physicists and astronomers. And basically, they appeal to virtual particle production. And this is something we know actually happens, that you get these quantum space-time fluctuations, and even if they're very small, once in a while, those fluctuations will pop into existence a particle. That's virtual particle. But we call them virtual particles because the laws of quantum mechanics tell us that that particle that pops into existence from the quantum space-time fluctuations must return to the quantum space-time fabric in less time than it's possible for the human observer to grab that particle and keep it. And typically we're talking time frames that are less than a trainth of a second. But we know from measurements that these virtual particles actually are coming into existence and going back out of existence at that rapid rate. Well, what atheists have done is say, why can't we have the universe come to existence by that means? Here's the fatal flaw. The more mass you try to bring into existence from these quantum space-time fluctuations, the faster it must return to the quantum space-time fluctuations. In the case of something as big as an electron, it's about a trainth of a second. For something as massive as the entire observable universe, the return time is 10 to the minus 122 seconds. That's 0.000121 zeros and a one. Now, I know there are people here that have a young Earth perspective. I refer to myself as a middle-aged creationist because I believe in only billions of years. Technical point here, 100 years ago, there was a young universe, old universe debate in astronomy. One side was saying quadrillions of years. The other side was saying billions of years. It's only billions of years. And incidentally, what was driving that debate? They knew that billions of years was not enough time to support the Darwinian paradigm. They needed more time. And so people say, we got to have at least quadrillions of years. But the evidence now tells us it's not extremely old. However, regardless of your perspective, I think we all agree that the universe is a lot older than 10 to the minus 122 seconds. I mean, every one of you here is older than 10 to the minus 122 seconds. So again, you're living proof that the universe did not come about by virtual particle creation. But probably the one you're most familiar with is the multiverse. And I remember back in the 1980s predicting that eventually the fine-tuning evidence for God creating the universe and shaping and fabricating it so that human life would be possible would become so overwhelmingly strong that atheists would have no other option but to propose the multiverse. Now, what I find interesting, they didn't do it until they were forced into it, where they had no other option. And if you're not familiar with the multiverse, it's this idea that we can get rid of the fine-tuning of God's design by simply appealing to the possibility, again without any observational evidence, that there's an infinite number of universes, and all these universes are different. And so if you've got an infinite number of universes where each one is different, one of them will have all the fine-tuned characteristics necessary to make possible the existence of life and human beings in particular. And so we didn't come here as a result of God creating the universe, the multiverse did it. Well, there's some fatal flaws with this. Number one, no multiverse model escapes the space-time theorem. No matter how many universes God brings into existence, they're all subject to the space-time theorems. So it doesn't really eliminate the existence of God. It simply is an attempt to eliminate the idea that there's a personal God that has designed the universe for the specific benefit of human beings. That's basically the limit. Okay. But my colleague, Jeff Swearing, has actually written a whole book on how to respond to atheistic versions of the multiverse. And I say atheistic versions because the multiverse actually has its origin in the Christian theology of the Middle Ages, where theologians in the Middle Ages were saying nothing less than an infinite universe befits an infinite God. So it's interesting that these atheists are borrowing a Christian idea to sustain the idea that God did not design the universe for our specific benefit. Now, I'm only going to offer you a few critiques because I want to leave some time for Q&A. But here's one, and I think it's a devastating one, that these multiverse models, and I call them deistic multiverse models because they don't avoid God, they simply avoid a personal God. So it's still deism. You still need a God to explain where all these universes come from. But they explain too much. Yes, you can appeal to an infinite number of universes to explain away all the design we see in the universe to make possible our existence. But at the same time, it would explain away every possible design. And not only is capable of explaining away all the design that God put into the universe, it also explains away all the designs that we human beings have ever achieved. So, for example, I could argue, based on the multiverse, that there will be an infinite number of planets and an infinite number of universes, somewhat like planet Earth. And on those infinite number of Earths, there's going to be an infinite variety of tree species. And there's going to be an infinite variety of tree species that are kind of like birch trees. You know what birch trees are like? They have this peeling bark. And the bark that peels is white. Well, with an infinite number of universes, there's going to be at least one species of birch trees that peels these white sheets of bark that are 8.5 by 11 inches. And they fall on the ground, and with an infinite number of universes, there'll be an infinite number of planets where you're going to have soil that will put ink-like markings on these 8.5 by 11 pieces of bark that fall off of these birch trees. And with an infinite number of universes, the markings that you'll see on those 8.5 by 11 pieces of bark coming off the trees will be identical to all the equations and letters and numbers that you see in this research paper and in the research paper of every other scientist that's ever been published. So I could go to the authors of this paper and say, you didn't publish this, the multiverse did. And that's what I mean. It explains too much. It literally explains away all design. So you're basically showing the atheist, if you're going to appeal to the multiverse to get rid of God's design, you're simultaneously getting rid of all the evidence for your design and the design of every human being. Do you really want to live like that? You're basically exposing that they're being philosophically inconsistent in that appeal. A second point. We see overwhelming evidence for design for the benefit of human beings on all observable size scales. Whether we're looking at fundamental particles, or we're looking at dimensions that are as small as 10 to the minus 20 meters, or we're looking at clusters of galaxies, or the large-scale structure of the universe, and everything in between, wherever we can observe, we see overwhelming evidence for design for the specific benefit of life and us human beings in particular. And so what you're basically exposing is you're just claiming that if we go to a level where we can't observe, then suddenly all that design goes away. But everywhere we can observe, we see an overwhelming case. And if you want to see evidence for that overwhelming case, reasons.org/fine-tuning. It's a free compendium we make available. It's 300 pages long, but documents over 1,000 different design features of our universe, our galaxy, and our planetary system that must be exquisitely fine-tuned to make possible our existence. You really do see an overwhelming case at all size scales, whether it be our galaxy, 200 different features of our Milky Way galaxy must be fine-tuned to make our existence possible. That's what makes it difficult for me to watch the Star Wars series. They immediately start off with a galaxy far, far away. I said, wait a minute. We astronomers have looked far, far away. We don't see any galaxies other than our own, which could be a candidate for advanced life. So yeah, they need to rewrite the scripts. Okay. And a third point is that these multiverse models are being proposed because they say there's no way to test them. We have no, and that's true. It's impossible, based on the theory of general relativity, for observers in this universe to ever observe another possible existing universe. We can only observe out to the space-time extent of the universe in which we live. If God made two, it's impossible for us to see the second one. If he made 10,000, it's impossible for us to see any of those 10,000. We can only make observations in our particular universe. And on that basis, atheists are comfortable saying, well, my hypothesis can't be tested. But I would argue there is a way to put it to the test. And I was going to draw out a Canadian coin from my pocket and to flip it in front of you. It's in my briefcase back here, but I'm not going to go get it. But for example, if I were to flip a coin in front of you 10 times and it came up heads all 10 times, you'd be more than justified in concluding the coin has been designed to come up heads all 10 times. What if it came up heads 1,000,000 consecutive times? Well, someone appealing to the multiverse could say, well, in an infinite number of universes where you get an infinite number of people flipping coins for an infinite number of time, one of them is going to come up with 1,000,000 consecutive heads. I mean, that's possible. But would you be willing to bet tails on the 1,000,000th and first flip if you saw 1,000,000 consecutive heads? I would advise you not to bet on tails until you at least look at both sides of the coin. Or measure the coin in some way to see if it's been weighted to always come up heads. You say, well, can we do that with the universe? Yeah, we can. We can choose to measure the universe in more detail in the next month than we've been able to do since the beginning of human history. And if measuring in more detail, we see that the evidence that has been designed for our specific benefit goes up and not down. That's evidence in favor of Christianity and evidence against atheism. Now it is such, and you can see this documented on reasons.org/fine-tuning. The evidence, as we learn more and more about the universe, goes up at a rate of at least a factor of 1,000 times per month. The discipline of astronomy and physics is advancing at such a rate that we're actually accumulating evidence at a rate of a factor of 1,000 per month, which means next month we'll have 1,000 times more evidence than we have today. So I can share with the atheists, if you're not convinced today, wait 1 month and see what happens to the evidence. But you'll see documented at reasons.org/fine-tuning that the evidence has been getting a roughly a factor of 1,000 or better over the last 25 years. There's been a consistent trend over the past 25 years. And that's why we're committed to keep researching the scientific literature. But here's kind of the bottom line. Avoid the absolute proof trap. So often I've run into atheist scientists, and they'll say, I'm not going to believe in your God until I see absolute proof that God exists. Or they put it this way, until you can eliminate all possible non-theistic arguments, empirical and non-empirical, I'm not going to believe in your God. It's impossible for any of us to provide absolute proof of anything. Typically when that happens, I say, well, I can't give you absolute proof that my wife exists. I mean, she's sitting outside this room here, but I can't give you absolute proof that she exists. I've only been married to her for 40 years. I don't have absolute proof. I mean, it's possible that I've been fooled by a very sophisticated hologram all these years. That's a possibility. But what I do have is practical proof. In fact, on our wedding day, I was reassuring my wife that I didn't have absolute proof of your existence, but I had sufficient practical proof that I was prepared to commit the rest of my life in marriage to her. But I can share this with you. I have more proof today than I had the day we got married, because I've been continuing to make observations and experiments, and those observations and experiments are giving me more and more evidence that she really does exist. But I still lack absolute proof. But so often, that's what atheists demand. We won't believe until we see absolute proof. And because we're humans, limited to the space-time dimensions of the universe, there will always be gaps in our knowledge. And when the atheist is demanding absolute proof, he's basically saying, until all the gaps are closed, I won't believe. Well, we'll never close all the gaps. Because of our human limitations, there's no way we're going to learn everything there is to learn about the universe. That's comforting for me as an astronomer. I will not be unemployed. There will always be more things to learn about the universe. Same thing's true about the Bible. You're not going to exhaust the Bible. There's always more to learn of what God is communicating through the Bible. And often we get accused of appealing to God of the gaps. How often have you heard that? You Christians are just appealing to God of the gaps. Well, the truth is, gaps exist on both sides. There are theistic gaps, there are non-theistic gaps. But that gives us an opportunity to put these two competing models to the test. We test them by what happens to the gaps. Yes, we've got gaps of ignorance. But as we learn more and more about the record of nature, do the gaps from a theistic perspective get smaller or do they get bigger? Do they get more numerous or less numerous? Do they get more problematic or less problematic? And then the nature of the gaps. Do the naturalistic explanatory gaps get more or less numerous, bigger or smaller, or more or less problematic as scientists learn more and more about the record of nature? This is why the Bible exhorts us. Yes, study the scriptures, but also study the record of nature. Christianity is a two-books theology. God gave us two books of revelation, the book of nature and the book of scripture. And in studying the book of nature, do we see that the gaps from a theistic perspective, a Christian theistic perspective, do they get progressively smaller and smaller and less numerous and less problematic? That's the mission of Reasons to Believe. We publish our books and our DVDs basically to demonstrate that indeed, as we learn more and more about nature, we see a more and more compelling case for the God of the Bible. And on a naturalistic side, we've got this major problem. They're claiming that that which has no consciousness, that which is impersonal, has no intelligence, no knowledge, creates that which is conscious, personal, intelligent, and knowledgeable. That violates the principle of cause and effect. That principle, effects cannot be greater than the causes. And so that's a fundamental weakness of atheism. They're basically claiming that which has no personality, knowledge, or intellect, capacity to love, creates that which has all those. Basically making us greater than the cause of the universe. And we also document in our books, so when it comes to the origin of the universe, the origin of the earth, life, and human beings, and the fine-tuning, the gaps from a Christian perspective are getting dramatically larger and larger for the non-theists. Probably the best example of that is our book, Origins of Life. In fact, we just got back from an Origins of Life research conference, and it's interesting. Every time we go to one of their meetings, the spirit within the conference center gets more depressing and more despondent because they realize that it's getting more and more challenging to sustain their non-theistic perspective. I was here speaking last year in this book, Improbable Planet, and it's basically a book where we surveyed the scientific literature over a three-year period, demonstrating that everything we see in the universe, the Earth, and the history of Earth's life plays a role in making possible the redemption of billions of human beings in a short window of time. And that book is out there at the table. And that's one of the best ways I've found to sustain the fine-tuning argument. The universe is not just fine-tuned to make possible your existence. It's fine-tuned to make possible your salvation by the creator of the universe. With that, I'm going to take the remainder of the time for questions, and you can ask me a question on any subject. It doesn't have to be in today's talk. Yes. Thank you.
Well, you said page 173, so you're obviously familiar with Lawrence Krauss. So what is your take on his, what's it, negative energy and redefinition of nothing?
Yeah, and when he talks, the question was my response to Lawrence Krauss in his book, A Universe from Nothing. And if you go on our reasons.org website, all you got to do is put Lawrence Krauss's name in. It will pop up a 16-page review I wrote of that book. And it's in two parts, so that's available for free for you to check out. But one of the things I point out in that review is that every one of the nothings that Lawrence Krauss appeals to is actually something. And actually, that I used that as a basis for a sermon I gave in my home church, where I said, everything you want to know about nothing, and talked about the nine different definitions of nothing that scientists have, and how every one of those definitions actually is something. So, for example, he appeals to virtual particles and say, look, we get particles out of nothing. But it's not out of nothing. It's out of space-time fluctuations. And just like you can take energy and convert it into matter, and matter into energy, you can take space-time fluctuations and convert that into matter. And so just like E equals mc squared, general relativity tells us you can convert the space-time fabric into matter, but it's not reversible. You can't take and bring it back the other way. So basically the universe starts off with no matter and no energy, but it has extreme space curvature. And as the universe expands, that curvature is released, and that produces the energy and the particles. So it's not nothing. It's actually something. And likewise, when he talks about negative energy and positive energy and canceling it off, it's simply analogous to what we call potential energy and kinetic energy. So, for example, if I've got a steel ball, I could drop it. It's got potential energy. If I drop it, it's going to get kinetic energy. And just by setting up the frame of reference, you can have the kinetic energy exactly equal to the potential energy, where the signs are opposite, they cancel off and they're zero. But it's not actual nothing. You still got that steel ball there. It just has different conditions. So anyway, you'll see the review on reasons.org.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I just finished Navigating Genesis book, and so I'm going to go off topic here.
No, that's fine. I'm giving you permission.
Yeah, thank you for that. And yeah, in there you talked about the ice cores that are available, these to show, you know, hundreds and thousands of years of geological history of
right.
The Earth. Now, I don't recall that you drew any conclusions about the current arguments what do we call climate change?
What kind of change?
Climate change?
Climate change, yes.
Okay, and I promised my son, who we're at this spot that you're talking about, and I said, I promised I'd ask you about this, as to what your views are. Do those cores, can they provide us scientific evidence that what is happening today in the climate is man-made, is occurring at a rate that never occurred before, that's so forth.
Okay, I'll be addressing your question very briefly during my plenary talk. I addressed it in some detail in my plenary last year, which I think is still available, and you can actually see it all documented in the book Improbable Planet, and then another book that's not here is Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. But basically what those ice cores show us is that there are at least seven different variations in the orbit of the Earth about the Sun and the tilt of our rotation axis. And this is what causes the ice age cycle, where the coverage of ice on planet Earth cycles between 10% and 20 to a little more than 20%. But because of these seven different cycles, what you see during the Ice Age cycle is extreme climate instability. And so throughout the whole history of the Ice Age cycle, except for the last 9,000 years, the global mean temperature has been jumping up and down by 24 degrees Fahrenheit over time scales of one or two centuries. And that explains why the first humans were not able to establish large-scale agriculture. Because of the extreme climate instability, their farms were tiny. Now, we used to think that these first humans just weren't doing anything sophisticated at all. We now know that's not true. And you'll see this in Improbable Planet. They were actually growing grains, harvesting the grains, roasting the grains, grinding the grains, and making bakery products. So very sophisticated, but all done on a tiny scale. Why? Because of the extreme climate instability. So they were forced to plant, say, 12 crops and have 9 crops fail, and they would feed their family and the 3 that made it. So they were forced into mixed farming on a small scale. Starting 9,000 years ago, these 7 different orbital cycles all came into sync. And for the first time in the Ice Age cycle, we transition from extreme climate instability to climate stability. The global mean temperature has not changed by more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the last 9,000 years. And that's what's enabled large-scale agriculture and billions of humans to live on the planet at one time. But I argue in my book that's all part of God's plan. He wanted to redeem billions of human beings. That meant that the planet had to have the conditions to permit the existence of billions of human beings, which meant it also required large-scale agriculture. But I argue in Improbable Planet and Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, this period that we've been enjoying for the past 9,000 years is temporary. We know from the ice cores and we know from the physics of the orbit of the Earth about the Sun, it's going to come to an end. And when it comes to an end, we're going to go back to the temperature jumping up and down by 24 degrees Fahrenheit, which means we're going to have to abandon large-scale agriculture and also will no longer be able to sustain billions of human beings. Sounds depressing, but I end the book in chapter 16 with an optimistic note. I think there's good evidence we can fulfill the Great Commission before this period of extreme climate stability ends. And the Bible's already promised if we do that, we get to leave this creation and enter into a brand new creation. Or no longer are we going to have to be concerned about climate instability. So, my exhortation to all of you, let's get the Great Commission fulfilled before we enter this period of extreme climate instability. All right.
Hey, Dr. Ross, I thank you for your talk now. I've had a few conversations where we get back to the singularity of the beginning of the universe, and then it gets to we can't know what happens before that.
Right.
In the sense, so various art, like the Colin cosmological argument, uses the law of cause and effect to say that the cause has to be greater than the effect. And then the response essentially is, that's true for within our universe, but can we apply that to the universe itself? So, like, can we use that law of cause and effect to apply it to, say, the singularity of the beginning of the universe? And how would you respond to that?
Yeah, good question. A lot of Christians think the Colin cosmological argument is all they need to establish that there's a God that created the universe and the universe had a beginning. Well, because of quantum gravity speculations, that's not sufficient. You have to close the door on that, which is why I began a lot of my talk on that very point. And so what I encourage Christians is you need to buttress the Colin cosmological argument with the space-time theorems. And now when people say, well, we don't know what's going on before 10 to the minus 43 seconds, we actually do. Because of these images of quasars and blazars, we got a tool to penetrate that era. We don't have to build a 6 quintillion mile long particle accelerator. We can actually do it by observing the images of these distant quasars and blazars. And also, we got a new tool coming which is looking at the orbits of stars just outside the event horizons of supergiant black holes. We don't have that yet, but we'll have that within a couple of months. So, yeah, combine the arguments, and then you've got a powerful case.
Front right.
So, recently the Richard Dawkins Institute came out with with a study, or actually I guess a paper, where they talked about the fact that the energy of light is sufficient to create life, and therefore there is no need for a God. In my opinion, that in fact proves the existence of God as God presents himself in the Bible. What would you respond to that, and are you aware of this finding by the Richard Dawkins Institute?
Okay. I had a hard time hearing because there's a lot of feedback on the microphone, so let me review to see if I got it. You're referring to a paper where they claim that the energy of light can create light? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically what the premise was is that the advent of the energy of light actually creates, or is sufficient wholly to create life, instead of an almighty God being able to be the force.
Oh, you're talking about the origin of life?
Not the origin of light, but light itself as a cosmological energy force is sufficient to create life out of nothing or out of matter. This was their finding. My thinking is that in the Bible, God calls himself light. Numerous times he describes himself as light. Their ultimate claim was that this proves Christianity false because God does not exist. I think it proves the exact opposite. I wanted to know if you were aware of that claim and what your thinking would be on it.
Yeah, okay. One journal you need to be careful about is Physics Letters B, and there's actually a couple of other journals like that. They're basically journals that allow people to speculate, physicists to speculate about things that we know are not true, mainly because there's the opportunity of developing mathematics that could prove useful in other areas. So there actually are physics journals dedicated to things we know are not true. And what you're describing is a paper that violates the theory of general relativity. The theory of general relativity tells us that, yes, the universe begins without light, just highly curved space-time. And as that space-time unfurls, as the universe expands from the cosmic creation event, and this happens when the universe is a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old, you get photons, and now you've got light. So it's not that light creates light. The universe actually begins without photons, but the photons show up quite early. And from a biblical perspective, yes, all kinds of texts refer to God being light, especially John and the Gospel of John, but John also wrote 1 John. And whenever I have a bunch of brand new believers, the first place I take them is 1 John. Because 1 John actually breaks down for exactly what is this light that God brings into the heart of every human being. And what you see in 1 John, chapter 1, God is light. But then chapters 2, 3, and 4 break that down and says the light of God has three components. So what you see in chapter 2, one of those components is life, and how the second person of the Trinity bestows life upon creation. And then chapter 3, it says God is love. And there it's identifying God the Father. He's the one that bestows love upon his creatures. And chapter 4 refers to the Holy Spirit bestowing truth. So the light of God is a combination of life, truth, and love. It's got nothing to do with electromagnetism. And so it's a mistake to look at these references of God being light. And I think that applies too to what you see in the new creation, where it talks about the light of God, and there is no darkness. And, you know, I make the point in my book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, in the new creation, there is no electromagnetism. There won't be photons. It'll be a completely different kind of light. But what's going to be coming out of that light will be God's life, truth, and love, and could be a whole lot more as well. Now, does that adequately answer your question? Okay. We got time, though. We're out of time, so I'm going to have to let you go. Thank you.